The 2006 Sunstone Symposium Dallas presents Session 7, Stages of Faith in a Mormon Context, a presentation by Tom Kimball and Dan Weatherspoon.
We're here to wrap up the Sunstone Symposium. Thank you for staying around this long, everybody. It's really really been a fun day. I think it's just been terrific. This is our seventh session, so fidgeting is certainly allowed, standing up, stretching. But we deliberately put this session at the end of the program because Tom and I have a real low-key attitude about what we're about to present on. I don't know how many of you, the reason for doing this is we've had such a really an interesting response to a podcast that Tom and I did, which is a three-part podcast. Over 500 people have downloaded it. He and I have been getting phone calls from people saying, wow, this has really affected my life positively. Somebody sent in $250, you know, because of this. And it's one of those things where, you know, Tom and I have been having a conversation for 5 or 6 years together. Yeah, okay. So, okay, I'm terrible at years, you know. I read James Fowler's work on Stages of Faith originally in 1988. But then it was in 1997 that it actually began to affect my life. And so apparently what we're talking about here is of interest to, I think, a lot of people who are in this room. So let me just quick. I'm Dan Weatherspoon, editor of Sunstone. This is Tom Kimball, a good friend of mine. We worked together at Benchmark Books starting 8 years ago, apparently. And that's where we began these conversations where I'd kind of... Yeah, that's right. He started on St. Patrick's Day, so just yesterday, 9 years ago. And we started talking about these concepts and stuff like that, but he's now the marketing director of Signature Books, and you probably know I've been the editor of Sunstone for about the last 5 years. So we're going to talk about James Fowler's Stages of Faith, and especially wherever possible, just to kind of tie it in with Mormonism. So whereas we have a general theoretical model, we're going to do things. And my role on this will be to just simply lay out the stages of faith, very brief, talk about it. I want Tom to interrupt me. I want you to interrupt me. I'm going to really send the microphone out there, you know, rather than repeat questions. And so let's just kind of make this a great conversation if we can. So before we begin, we'd love to know who has read James Fowler before themselves. Okay, Phyllis has read it. Who has heard of him and have heard of this book? Okay. Anybody have heard the podcast? Okay. Actually, Tom's been organizing panels and things at the last 3 or 4 Sunstones on this, and, you know, hundreds of people are showing up sometimes, so anyway, we think it's some neat stuff that's really helped our lives to kind of, and especially making peace within the Mormon tradition for ourselves. So my role will be just simply to breeze through a basic overview of what James Fowler's work is. Tom will kind of tell he's brought a paper that he's prepared to kind of tell his Mormon journey and how this has affected it, but we really want to make this a free-flowing conversation if we can. Anyway, James Fowler's book, Stages of Faith, Phyllis was telling me that she got the first edition right when it first came out earlier, which is in the mid-80s. I'm pretty sure, yeah, it was in the early 80s. Fowler and his team of researchers interviewed hundreds of people, hundreds and hundreds of them, it's probably more than 500, and of all ages, and they were specifically asking open-ended questions that people would just have a general response to, and as they would track the data on the questionnaires, they would go back and put it out there, and, well, maybe I better start. James Fowler was trained by Eric Erickson, who is a pioneer in child development theory. You've probably heard of Piaget and then Eric Erickson, and these are people that talk about childhood development kind of goes through normal progressions and stages. So he already had in his brain a model of you know, human development according to stages and courses. This kind of work that Fowler did is also similar to the kind of work that Lawrence Kohlberg did on moral development, that somehow or other we, you know, at first we're, you know, we do what's right because of fear. Eventually it moves on to this. You know, eventually you go from rules to principles to, you know, just things like that. Carol Gilligan is another famous, she was a student of Kohlberg's. Anyway, this whole idea of faith development, or of stage development theory, was a well-worn path before Fowler. But Fowler and his gang were specifically asking faith questions, questions about religion. And so of all the different things that you can track as a developmental thing, they were specifically looking for that. So they would interview all these people, and then they would get the data together, and they began to notice groupings of similar responses for this and that and the other thing. And they ended up looking at this and deciding that the best way to artificially divide this was in six levels of development. And again, some of the levels of development were very small groups, like his stage six. I think he estimates that less than 2% of human beings ever achieve this stage six sort of spiritual awareness. Anyway, the whole point is he did six. But what the reason for me even bringing up that they just divided it in six, it's arbitrary. Other theorists talk three stages. Some put it at nine stages. You know, things like that. So faith development, we're not talking about hard and fast boxes here. We're looking at tools and theoretical tools for sort of naming things and sort of grouping them and hopefully being able to discuss.
But they're useful. I mean,
yeah.
They seem to fall within groupings.
Yeah. So. And again, one of the things I like to always emphasize about this is really what he's trying to do is a descriptive project. What Tom and I are doing here is we're saying, and I think it's, we're not alone here because I know this is a phenomenon among other religions and stuff like that, but the descriptive project has this effect on spiritual seekers that you know, moves far beyond just trying to describe it. It has this ability to feel, you know, to have. I know for me at least, as I struggled with my faith, especially in the 80s and 90s, and it gave me that feeling that, okay, even if I'm not quite in step with Mormonism, or at least what I'm getting in Sunday school, I'm somehow on a spiritual path. And I'm part of a community of spiritual travelers for thousands of years and in all the different traditions. So there's that sense of that you're not alone in going through these things. Yeah. So anyway, with that as a really haphazard introduction, let me just quickly lay out the six stages. Tom will kind of talk about his personal journey within this, and then we'll just kind of see how the discussion goes, how much energy there is, and we're not married to a particular length on this other than, you know, don't feel guilty if you made plans based on what the program says about time to leave. Fowler has six stages. The first stage, though, he actually does have a pre-stage, which is basically from birth to age two, where an infant, it is a very important stage because up to age two, before language emerges and stuff like that, is really the time in which the infant sort of gets a sense of whether or not the world welcomes his or her presence. Mom is here. Good, I feel comforted. She walks away. Oh no, I'm nervous. But she comes back. Yay. You know, you get that sense about whether or not the universe is a friendly place or not, whether or not you're an intrusion, etc. And we've all heard of the stories about the children who don't get that kind of attention, who don't get held. So things can go wrong. It's a very important time in life to sort of intuit the universe and get a feel for it. But he hasn't put that as a faith stage because, again, there's no language that sort of emerges. But beginning about age two with the emergence of language, we have what he has as his first stage, which he calls the intuitive projective stage. And we'll kind of talk about why those are good words here. Language emerges. You begin to be able to match sounds with objects. You develop the ability to walk. you know, to talk, to name things. You discover the power of naming. It's within this this time of discovery that fantasy begins to emerge for the child. And so you're basically, during this very early stage, you're intuiting the world and you're projecting your presence in it. So that's where his intuitive and projective things. And this is about age 2 up to age 5 or 6, about the time you start to school. This is the major tasks there to do that. And again, we're going to really focus on the adult stages in a minute, so I'm really moving fast. The second stage, again, at the beginning of school or something, he begins to call the mythic literal stage. This is when Piaget, and one of the interesting things to me is that some tasks are just impossible before your brain can, you know, your brain's continuing to develop after you're born. And so there's certain things that you just can't do until your brain catches up with the ability to do it. So anyway, by the time you get to school, you're in what Piaget says that you have concrete operational thinking. You have this ability to have a linear world. And so when you're able to have a linear world, that means you can kind of have beginnings and middles and ends and so on and so forth. And so the main thing that emerges here is story. So that's why he calls it the mythic literal story, mythic literal stage. Story emerges, narrative emerges that begin for a child to really form meaning in their life for the first time. But on the other hand, there's not really an understanding of an inner life. You know, this is how people act, is the way it is. And so with a child, and many of you probably recognize this up until, you know, through adolescence, you know, here's the story. Here's the way you're supposed to act. You better act this way. So how many of your children at this phase are the moral cops in your house? Things like that. It's because their life is ordered, and there's a story, and there's a way it should be. But there's no sense that, you know, well, sometimes you break these rules because of this, and there's that sort of stuff that goes on there.
Chad, he'll say, that man smokes, yeah. You know.
And that means bad,
right.
You know. Then there's no sense of nuance or something like that. And so the one big difference here between this stage and what emerges in the next stage, which we'll really start talking about, is that in this stage 2, you have a bunch of stories, but you don't have an overarching story that fits them all together. You don't have the story of stories. In other words, so you've seen the kids, and if you read his book, it's just terrific. He quotes some of the interviews. These kids have these most amazing tales of, you know, how this works, and the next breath they'll have something about how this works, but there's not a possible way that those two stories could fit in the same universe together, you know. So it's just, you know, they get going and they love it, all that stuff, but they don't have that ability to sort of tie it all together as an overarching story. Well, finally, you reach early adolescence, and you have the emergence of what he would classify people as stage 3, and that he calls the synthetic conventional. So the word synthetic, what does it mean? Bringing together. So this is the synthesizing stage in which you can begin to develop this story of stories. But guess where you get that story from? If you're a child and you're all of a sudden beginning to have a real worldview that overarches it, what's the source for that?
Primary.
Yeah, in the church, it's primary. It's your parents. It's your culture. It's basically, it's the inherited story. And so all of us grow up, you know, with all these different stories. Sometimes it's religious stories. Sometimes it's the family, you know, what's that, holes, the family curse, you know, or so that you have all these stories. If we were born in America, that pride in being an American, you know, patriotism, you know, et cetera. So these are the stories that we do. We begin to take perspective in relationship with others to this. This is why what happens in junior high and all that stuff with kids. They start worrying about what other people think of them. Remember back, you know, when you're 8 or 9 years old, you're singing, you're dancing, you're not, you know, you're the center of the universe. So like, finally here in this stage 3, you begin to say, oh, I'm in relationship with others. And I start caring about them. And you begin to recognize what facial expressions mean. And you get feedback and peer pressure and all that stuff kind of does there. But again, the values and the symbols come from others, your family, your religion, your teachers, your parents. And it's a story of stories, but it's not really one that you've broken apart yourself. One of my favorite phrases from the Fowler material is, and again, I've heard it outside this material, but I think he uses it very effectively, it's the idea of, we're not sure who discovered the properties of water, but we're pretty sure it's not the fish. In other words, when you're swimming in something, you can't really analyze it. It's just the environment that you breathe, that you live, and so on and so forth. So a stage three person is somebody who within, or not, I don't like to say person, but a person who at least his faith is in this, what he would call stage three, is somebody who can do amazing things with that story. It makes perfect sense. It's you know, I just think of what you can do when you really buy into the scriptural worldview, or when you buy this, you can do these incredible things, but it's not a story that you've actually analyzed. One of my favorite experiences in my Bountiful Ward back, really during a time when I was really struggling, was a guy who ended up becoming a friend of mine, who stood up in the sacrament meeting one day, and I have a spontaneous testimony, Boris testimony, I know the church is true, and then all of a sudden he stopped and goes, you know, I've never really asked myself if it might not be true. You know, and so right there I identified this guy as somebody that's a guy that's worth getting to know, because he at least began to have, you know, at least for me, you know, a kindred sense of maybe a willingness to begin to ask
stage
about that.
Three, you might liken to the missionary. Okay, he's 19 years old. He hasn't actually, you know, in my case, you know, I hadn't read the scriptures yet, and yet I was sent to Alabama, you know, and I was creating my worldview from my tradition, and it worked, and I was able to do amazing things, telling people about it and synthesizing and having stories about it, but really, I hadn't really given it a really critical, you know, from the outside, but from the inside, it was dynamic. And so that's sort of
age group. What age is that?
From early adolescence, and I was, in fact, the next thing I was going to say is he says that about 60% of people never, you know, so this is the stage that many people die in.
Oh, die.
Yeah, because again, and in fact, I'll talk about some of the key triggers that he'll talk about for the move to stage four, or at least the beginning forays into the next one. A lot of times, it's college. You know, because again, that's the first time, especially if you move away from home for college, you know, you're exposed to new ideas, new people, new experiences, etc., and you begin to start to analyze and say, wow, there is more than one way to think about this. You know, here's a person perfectly functioning in their tradition, or at least or in their atheism or whatever it is, and they seem to believe it just as much as I, and so that'll often be a trigger. Other times it'll be things like just doing a lot of reading. Somebody mentioned earlier today books as a gateway to you know, again, problematizing some aspects of it. Often it'll be tragedy. You know, you have this sense that the world's supposed to work this way. Phil talked about superstitious religion, that if I do this, this is it. And sometimes, whether it's so bad, you know, for instance, Gail's not here, Clifton, but I know that the Holocaust sent a large number of Jewish folks into atheism, because this all of a sudden was something that my worldview, there's no way in any conception of God I've ever had could he allow this, you know? And so it is. So sometimes it's tragedy or something like that that will bump somebody into a situation that for stage four, which Fowler labels individuative and reflective. So individuative, all of a sudden, instead of what the family, what others have talked to me, it's decision-making for myself. And then reflective, it's that out the fish out, you're not the fish inside the water. You're beginning to look at your worldview. You're looking at the stories of your tradition, your faith, etc. As you're reflecting on it, you become responsible for any feelings, ideas, choices, and beliefs yourself. You're still swimming in your story, but at least, you know, at least in the early part of it, you know, you're kind of both and you're beginning to ask those questions.
Maybe a quick analogy. Stage three is picture yourself in the center of your tradition, and your tradition is all around you. Stage four is when you start to find yourself looking into your tradition from the outside. Okay, does that work?
Being objective.
You're starting to look at it from the outside as opposed to being in the center of it and having it all around you.
Yeah, and whether true objectivity is ever, you know, yeah. But it's interesting. So I would probably just let you know my own experience with this book. 1988 was my first year of grad school in religion, master's degree, and my very first semester they have all the incoming guys take a class on methods, so different methods and ways of studying religion. And Fowler's was part of the unit on psychological approaches to religion. I read it, and, average book, you know, for the class. I had friends in that class that were just going ape over this book. They're just thinking that it was the most amazing thing in their life was encountering this book. And I just couldn't figure out what the buzz was all about. Well, at my very first semester of grad school, I was fighting grad school. I was willing to learn all the theories, but I wasn't willing to let them affect me. Essentially, I came into grad school as a high-functioning level three. In fact, I just had decided not to be a CES person. I mean, when my wife married me, I was in the classes to become a church education seminary guy, and when I decided I didn't like teenagers, you know, at least I like them now that I have them, but you know, at least I didn't want that to be part of my life. I you know, I knew I was motivated and animated by religion, but I decided to go to grad school in religion instead. And so I was pretty well just looking at grad school to sort of fortify, give me some extra stuff to be, you know, the Know Your Religion lecturer, you know, or whatever I could, you know, to do. And so I was fighting. So when I read Fowler here, I was still in stage three and I wasn't even interested that much, where my friends had been starting to pull apart their traditions, etc. So Tom's always making the point that unless you're in stage four, probably this stuff doesn't matter. It's just going to kind of roll over your head, and I think he's right.
In the mid-80s, I was a young chaplain, and Fowler came to the Air Force Chaplain School for a week seminar. So I sat in his class for a week listening to this firsthand, and I was, you know, I guess you might say you're high-functioning stage three. And he started explaining this, and I looked to my Mormon guy next to me, and I said, the church is true, the rest of this is irrelevant. And we just kind of kicked back and tuned out for the whole week. It didn't relate to anything. Because if this is true, the heck with all this other stuff.
Absolutely. And I'm trying to think, made me think of something right when you did it, but I lost it. But no, Fowler's, we had him to Sunstone. And similar experiences with some people. And again, it's not so much that you're not willing to say, well, I know what I was going to say. Here's the thing. Remember what the rhetoric is all through seminary, and it's what, get your own testimony. Don't rely on your parents' testimony. Get your own. And so what do? They encourage you to pray and to study all this, and you do this. And pretty much the social norm is that by the time you emerge as a seminary graduate or something, what? You're convinced that you've been through stage four. You know, if you were to read Fowler's book, you know, hey, I put it to the test. I had these spiritual experiences, and you know, a lot of people that I'll send this book to, they're convinced that they're stage five or six, which we'll get to, because they had they had one night of wrestling, you know, with it and got it. And so in some ways there is this rhetoric and this encouragement to not rely on us, but on the other hand, there's only one acceptable answer to those kinds of prayers. You know, if you were to get the answer to the prayer that the Book of Mormon wasn't true, what would happen? You know, all of a sudden section 50 of the dictionary, or the DNC will, or is it section 84, verse 50? I can't remember the one about, it must be sin in your life that you did it, you know, because there's no acceptable answer other than that. And so again, even though it's got the same message of find out for yourself, you don't always. And so, no, thanks for sharing that, Phil. Anyway, stage four for most people, again, is also a terminal stage in Fowler's model. Once you begin to... one of the words I should have brought up in talking about phase four is demythologizing. You know, you're born with stories, and when we say myth, we're not talking Hansel and Gretel. We're talking just the overarching stories that give meaning and value to you. And once stage four kind of kicks in and you begin to pull apart and demythologize, for many, what happens? All sort of hope that religion had any answers kind of begins to fade, because I can't count on that, and here's another thing I can't count on, and this, wow, and you know, I look at these other cultures and they're functioning just perfectly without, you know, God. You know, it's a, you know, the impersonal force over in the East and all the different things, and you kind of begin to give up on it. And stage four can be very much a terminal thing. And then there's also the issue of many people will venture into stage four. And again, not that these stages are anything. It's just weird for me to always catch myself talking about it. You'll kind of start asking stage four questions and you decide what? I ain't going there. I want to pay, pray, and obey. You know, I want to. And so there's this sense, and he talks about sometimes we'll do a willed naivete. In other words, as an act of will, I will choose not to look at these questions because I can tell, you know, the slippery slope that I'm about to get on, so forth. And so a lot of people who foray into stage four kind of stuff will, as an act of will, try to stay in stage three. I don't think they can accomplish that. But yeah. But yeah. But anyway, so.
Kind of the paradox, at least as I've seen it, is the church almost encourages you not to go into the stage four.
Absolutely.
And so when you start, at least for me, going into stage four, those that are, say, at stage three or within the church or the mainstream or whatever label we want to put on it, look at you as if you're doing something wrong. You shouldn't be going there. You shouldn't ask those questions. You shouldn't be, you know, thinking those type of thoughts. You shouldn't be reading those type of books. And, you know, you end up having your interview with your bishop and your stake president because you get up and you get upset in, you know, class because you ask questions and everybody gets all upset. So it's kind of this paradox because you grow up your whole life taught that faith revolves around your belief in the church. And then the second you start breaking away and analyzing that aspect of your faith, you're told you're doing something wrong. So, you know, but yet you feel like something's missing.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And what you said about they're only expected to do this and you can't step out of the Fowler, the very last chapter, and I typed the quote out and I left it over there with my notes, but he calls it he borrows Kenneth Kennison's phrase, but he says that every organization has a modal developmental level, and mode meaning the average. And so there's this idea that any culture, any family, any tradition, whatever, will encourage you to come up to a certain level of development and questioning. But if you're, as soon as you're to break that away, that is sort of the center of gravity, and there's going to be forces that keep you from moving or breaking off of that. So Nietzsche has the whole, you know, beware of the marketplace, because in the marketplace they say, you know, that, you know, We're all the same. And so he's telling you that you need to be to a higher thing. There's this idea, you know, you encourage that, you cut it out all the time, that, you know, hey, this is the way to be religious, but don't do Phil stuff. You know, don't do this extra stuff because, you know, that's not where the energy of the group is.
You're making me think about an experience I had at a state conference. And I've sat through lots of meetings in my life and don't remember a lot of what was said. But I will remember forever this speaker, fifth quorum member of the 70, who talked about when he was 21 years old being called to be a Sunday school teacher. And he had a concern about that because he was asking stage four kind of questions. And he was talking about this openly, speaking as the big authority at our state conference. And when he had these stage four questions, he talked with his bishop about it and kind of said, I'm not sure if I should be teaching. And he got tremendous support from his bishop saying, how good that you're asking these kind of questions. It's only when people ask these kinds of questions that they really have a an appropriate learning process, and I will remember that forever. And so I've, found some support within the church tradition for supporting stage four.
Up to a certain point to where all of a sudden you...
Well, we'll see.
And I was
wondering, this person's comment here that the church encourages stage three thinking.
My question was, how does it do that? And I'm not sure that it's institutionalized among the church. It might be institutionalized among the groups that we associate, some certain groups that we associate within the church. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. How do you think that that's institutionalized in the church?
Correlation does it to a large extent. Whenever you've been asked to teach a Sunday school class, you're not supposed to use outside material, only the approved material. Those type of things bring about this pressure to stay within the bounds that they define. And if you've ever taught a class, and granted some bishops are a little bit more open-minded about things and others are exceptions, but in general, the church really tries to define the box and try to keep you within that box.
Dan?
A lot easier to manage people in the box,
And I'd like to make a comment. I taught Sunday school for 25 years, and my biggest gripe, now I'm teaching priesthood, but my biggest gripe was that come Easter, we never had a lesson on Easter. And I wrote them in Salt Lake and everything else, and I'd get these stupid letters back and everything else. And so what I would do is when it came that Sunday, I gave an Easter lesson. If they didn't like it, they could fire me, and they never did.
We're firing you for teaching about the resurrection.
Okay.
Just one comment. I remember back in, I think it was either probably the early 60s, listening to President McKay talk in conference, message of some kind, where he makes a comment that to the people, he said, if you have doubts, that's okay. You can have doubts about the church and about what it teaches. That's okay. Keep those doubts. Put them on your shelf up here and hang on to them, and eventually you'll find the answers. But it's okay to have doubts. It's okay to have questions that you don't have answers for, because someday those answers will come. And I've never found that quote written anywhere since.
Didn't get those.
Yeah. No, you don't hear that today.
Yeah, President McKay and also President Brown, Hubie Brown, were especially good. In fact, it kind of fits good with this transition. Let me let you quickly alert you to what stage five is. But it's this idea that true faith needs to serve, and he called it a stewardship of doubt. In other words, and we have such a positive connotation for stewardship. In other words, it's an essential part for him. And so I don't want to come across it any way saying here that I don't think that any church leader has moved beyond stage three, that your bishop or this fellow who talked to you didn't have a great attitude and things like that. But again, we were talking about kind of the center of gravity of the church. And I do think that the lesson manuals and things do sort of, they're not pushing you to move outside the box. What happens for a fellow? And again, we have a lot of people who never move out of stage three, a lot of people never move out of four. Well, often what he says for someone who moves into five, it rarely happens before midlife. And if any of you can think about midlife and what that means, what are some of the things that a midlife crisis is usually about? Okay. Besides the physical stuff. Yeah, is this my life? Is this all there is to it? It's the roads taken, and that therefore there's some roads that are no longer options for me. You're both old and young. some of your friends are starting to die. You know, you start looking at the obituary and you actually know a person or two. And so there's this sense of your mortality sort of picking up again. Probably by this life you've met enough people in your life that you recognize again the important perspectives that other people can have. Clifton was great in talking about the role of paradox today, that comfortability with paradox is something that usually by mid-age you're at last quite ready to say, you know, maybe there isn't some hard and fast answer. Maybe there's a bunch of both and answers and instead of either or and things like this. One of my favorite lines from Fowler is he says, a lot of times what'll force somebody into stage five is the sacrament of defeat. In other words, you know, again, like stewardship is a positive thing. We think of sacrament there. This idea that life has kicked you in the butt a bit, and that is, it's a chastening and something to do it. So he calls stage five the conjunctive stage. And so that's based conjoin. And so where stage four was a pulling apart, a demythologizing stage, what happens, he says, around midlife and as people move into stage five kind of things, it's this putting back together. It's the revaluing of what you did. In other words, I may no longer believe this myth literally the way I did in stage two and stage three, but I can see the power of that story. And I can see the importance, the role that played in my development, in my child's. I can see why it works in my child's life.
But as I understand it, the emphasis is on confidence in your view and your interpretation, as opposed to the. Yeah.
Right. Again, because stage four has been that whole you making those kinds of things for yourself. But again, stage five, conjunctive, conjoining, meaning is there, both andness, comfortability with paradox. I may never know this answer, you know, exactly. Instead of God has laid out, you know, one plan for everyone to follow, stage five, and in fact, one of his, really, I recommend this book a lot to people. It's Becoming Adult, Becoming Christian. And to me, this is kind of the second half of stage five manual, where he talks a lot about learning your own vocation. In other words, instead of one path for everyone to follow, you know, here's the box, here's the path that everybody should do, it's learning your own specific vocation, what God is calling you to, and the surprise and the wonder that sort of can happen there. And these are all stage five things. So, and then one of my, this has been important, I think I've even written an editorial or two that touched on this, but one of the things that Fowler has really helped me with, and it's again, I'm not like saying I'm a stage five boy, you know, but I mean, there's a stage five concept that has really, I've been helped by this. And that is, he calls it the scandal of the particular. And it's comfortability with particularness. One of the phrases that you kind of hear when you talk about the scandal is, Clifton did about chosenness and Jewish, you know, how out of God to choose the Jews. You know, it's this idea, could anything good come out of Nazareth? It's this idea that how could some group or some person claim to have a universal truth to teach when we know where they came from? Nobody comes out of Nazareth with anything important. Why these people? You know, there's my favorite cartoon. I think it's a Grondahl. You have this computer screen and somebody person looking at it and the computer's like bouncing off the desk, you know, smoke coming out, and basically the conversation is, as the people are watching, it says it's trying to figure out what the odds are that a backwoods upstate New York tradition can become the one and only true church. It's this idea that you know, particularity is a scandal. And so what stage five and what Fowler kind of talks about is, okay, you know, yeah. Is there anything that escapes particularity? No. And so it's that comfortableness with, yeah, it's a specific time, place, social environment, cultural language thing, but it still can animate your life. And you know, Phil, the stuff Phil taught us this morning is all out of India, right? They had so many problems, and yet, you know, here's some wonderful truths and some traditions and teachings that have really helped him. And so that's sort of this conjunctive kind of there. Again, you see the forest and recognize that there is no forest without particular trees. You know, you have to have the trees as well as the forest. So again, I can't remember what his percentage is. I should have looked things up in the book again. I think his estimate is somewhere like maybe 20, 25% of people ever reach a stage five kind of perspective and make that sort of their center of gravity. And again, I was mentioning, it was the Sieverts who left earlier. They were saying how this was a session they really wanted to go, but they had to leave. But they were kind of saying, you know, so, because they'd heard our podcast, actually, and they said, so are y'all stage fives and stuff like this? And the whole point of it is, like, on a good day, yeah, maybe. But guess what happens when you're stressed out? All of a sudden, the stage four stuff. And so, you know,
isn't it more like a roller coaster ride, you know, stage four right here?
Yeah, and parts of you are in there, and there's certain buttons that, you know, if this button is pushed, you know, whatever unfinished business I have, you know, from you know, yeah, again, you can do it. And so again, these are not hard and fast things. But, you know, it's always this dialogue with my best self, my earlier stage self. And then just last, stage six, again, extremely rare. Yeah, he calls it the universalizing stage. Whereas in stage five, you're valuing truths and insights from wherever they are. At stage six, you've so internalized the values and the truth that you act in radical harmony with the full will of God. Well, again, some of his examples are Jesus, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King, Abraham Joshua Heschel, who's terrific. Love him, to read him. And it's this idea that you can't act in any way other than what's fed by this sense of universal justice, universal care, this truth. The hero song? Okay, well, I'll do that. But the one point I didn't want to lose while it was on my brain was... you did. What is it? That's six. Anyway, I'll come back to it. I'm sure I'll catch it up. There's a song. It's Phil Collins' song. David Crosby co-wrote it, but it's the hero, you know. But it's the idea of the hero never he knows what's right or wrong. You know, I wish it were that simple for me. The hero knows what he's supposed to do. I wish it were that simple for me, you know, kind of thing. This idea that there's no question anymore of weighing this. Here's the point that I really wanted to make. Fowler's contention is that, again, we talked about religions and traditions getting stuck things. He really does believe that most traditions are at a high level three functioning. That's the center of gravity. But his point is, Jesus's message, the message of Jesus's gospel, is a radical one, and it would lead you to a stage six. And so I think it's an important point to say that if you look at Jesus's life, you know, what does he say? If you've seen the Father, or if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. He talks about the language of I am the way, the truth, and the life as not being this great big theological thing that we're supposed to pick apart. It's like, I'm simply telling you the way it is. You know, my life is in such harmony that this is the way. This is the truth. This is the life. You know, can you sort of see that? He talks about stage six people often acting without concern or care for their own safety. That sounds like Jesus too. That sounds like Martin Luther King. That sounds like people, because again, you know, stage five, you're still in all these networks of relationships with people, and they're still pulling on you. Whereas stage six is a very dangerous kind of place where this radical being fed by the universal principles. So, Phyllis.
Well, I was going to say how I understand this stage is that you've internalized your values, and you're not working for rewards and punishments.
Right.
And I think in religion, so often they do things because they want to get a reward in heaven. Well, that's no consequence. You know,
right.
You're just doing the right thing to do the right thing.
Right.
Dave, yeah. Let me make a comment while you got it here. Tolstoy, who wrote War and Peace, also wrote a book which hardly any people know of, and it's called The Kingdom of God is Within You. And I don't know how many here have read it. Yeah, great book, isn't it? And what's really interesting about that is Gandhi was a radical lawyer in Durban, South Africa, and he was going to go back over to India and start Revolutionary War, the whole thing, until he read that book. And it completely changed him 180 degrees, and he became the pacifist leader he was. And millions, hundreds of millions of people were changed and influenced because of that little book.
Now, I'm really grateful for all the energy here. That's what I'm starting to worry about. I want to give Tom the chance to tell us, or maybe you can kind of skim parts or something here. But let's go to Phil, and then Tom will tell a very Mormon journey that'll kind of practicalize this, and then again we can decide how much longer to go or not.
Yeah, the quote by Jesus: "Straight is the." Straight is the way and narrow is the gate. Few there be that find it. See, a yogi would say it's not an organization. It's not the true organization. It's the consciousness of Christ. That's the straight way and the narrow gate, and few there be that find it. So that would be your universalizing.
Well, let's let Tom, it's a terrific paper. I've read it, and Tom's really the one who drives the boats of these for discussions, and I'm grateful for that. So let's hear from him probably just about 10-12 minutes, and
pull my pant leg.
Then we'll see.
Stage three. One of the problems with stage three is this idea that many have that it involves ranking. That someone is better or smarter than another at a later stage, or someone moves through these stages faster than another. Ken Wilber and other stage theorists point out that there are many developmental lines. Wilber talks about there being anywhere from 12 to 20 or more, depending on how fine you want to divide them up, and how human development in any one area can be related to biology, physiology, their communities, technological development, as we've talked about, their access to education, and their other opportunities. Faith is only one line in this developmental process. It seems to me that we as Latter-day Saints arrive at stage three when we become knowledgeable about our tradition and gain a sense that we are at the center of our tradition. Quite simply, we have all the answers to life's difficult questions. By the time I came home from my mission, I learned and tested Mormon narrative and found that it worked for me. And during my seminary years through my mission, I had developed the rhetorical skills that gave me the ability to articulate what seemed to be the answers to all of life's questions. There's often many different camps of stage three orthodoxy. Stage three for Latter-day Saints is a comfortable environment, and it's expected faith development for it's the expected faith development for our tradition. Stage four. Entrance into stage four usually occurs when, for whatever reason, a person finds that the answers provided by the church are no longer helpful or simply an error. I found that in my quest to satisfy myself with the answers to life's ongoing questions, I found problems with my tradition, specifically its history, and I could no longer just explain them away. Because I wasn't aware of stage theory, I was horrified at the prospect that my tradition had errors. So much of my life, my family, my worldview depended on this tradition, which received its direction about social issues from the divine, in which the moral principles of honesty and integrity were paramount. When these naive ideas of my tradition fell away, I found that the prospect of looking elsewhere terrifying, and I clung to them much longer than I needed to. In the late 90s, Dan introduced me to James Fowler, and for the first time I gave myself permission not to believe. It started when I began to peel away the layers of belief, starting with my faith in the Mormon hierarchy. But soon I found myself rejecting Joseph Smith, Jesus, and eventually God altogether. I had what happened in my life compared to throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But I felt that the tub needed a good scrub before I was ready to start searching for the child. An important thing to remember is that the worldview of stage four is just as black and white as the worldview of stage three.
And I still think that there's truth.
Right.
You know, yeah. And it's not there, so yeah. You know, I'm going to still find it, but you're still black and white.
My loss in these former pillars also spelled the end of my belief in metaphysical experiences. I allowed myself to embrace the idea that there is no life after death and to take on a very naturalistic worldview. Of course, this has had an effect on my family, my friends, my social structure. I'm sure that others risk losing a great deal, including their marriage, their family, and possibly their employment with such a venture. I understand this, and my heart goes out to them. I consider myself fortunate with regards to these issues. Though not unscathed, I feel that I have fared better than many. To those with stage three ears, listening to folks in stage four speak about their doubts is like listening to someone with a strange code. I find that I can have meaningful conversations about doubt with other doubters, including meaningful discussions of spirituality. I find that these same conversations with those in stage three leave me I find that these same conversations with people on stage three leave me feeling as if I've been labeled a heretic. I often find these exchanges spiritually deflating. I sometimes feel that I'm viewed as a project, and that with some work, one day I might be like them again. There is also suspicion that my doubts are caused by some type of serious sin, and that they are simply just something wrong with me. I've had two conversations over the past 7 years that I think about over again. One was with James Fowler himself. The other was with Jana Reese, the religion book editor with Publishers Weekly. I'll talk about them in different orders than they took place. Jana introduced me to a small body of literature, including a book by a 16th century mystic by the name of St. John of the Cross, who wrote a treatise that is now most often published under the title The Dark Night of the Soul. The mystic eventually explains that when people are ready, quote, God turns all this light into darkness and shuts against them the door and the source of the sweet spiritual water. He sets them down from his arms and teaches them to walk on their own feet. Close quote. Until this, it hadn't entered in my mind that doubt could be God's gift in my personal development. But this insight was essentially academic for me until November of 2004, when my youngest son turned 8. As a step towards baptizing this son, and shortly thereafter ordaining my other son to be a deacon, I was invited by my bishop to get a temple recommend. I respectfully declined the invitation I received to receive a recommend, but entered into his office to talk about performing the ordinances. He asked me why I wasn't interested in a recommend. Unprepared for the conversation, I responded that I had some issues of doubt, and that at the moment I felt that there was no possible answers to the kinds of questions that I had. In our discussion, he insisted I share an example of something I had doubts about. I had recently had a conversation with Dan about a similar experience that he had had with his bishop, and I decided that blurting off a laundry list of problems that I saw with Mormonism would be a mistake. But my bishop insisted on something, so I offered a concern about a recent Ensign article. I was pleasantly surprised to learn that he, at least initially, shared my concern. He later, at a later meeting, and what I felt was an attempt on his part to reduce his cognitive dissonance, he reduced my concern into something that it isn't. At this second meeting, I also informed him that my doubts would probably mean that I would not be allowed to exercise my priesthood on behalf of my sons. My wife consulted her father and about if I should conduct, how and who should conduct these ordinances. He suggested that I stay in the fight a little longer for the right to perform these myself. In the next meeting with my bishop, I expressed my intention that my wife would be present at all future meetings, and I informed him that I would be performing these ordinances or they would not take place. I posed the question that if I perform these ordinances in spite of my doubts, would my sons be any less members of the church? Would my sons not receive the Holy Ghost or the priesthood? His answer was that these ordinances would be technically valid. After the interview, my wife didn't find it funny that I suggested that my doubts had reduced me to the status of a woman in the church. It was a joke. I'm sorry. At some point, the interviews were kicked up to the stake president. He had essentially had the same questions, but the interesting note is that he teaches my kids in elementary school. And he knows my children by name. The process took 6 months, personal initiative on my part, several interviews with the bishop and the stake president to reach a resolution. In the final interview with my bishop, he said that he had blocked out an hour for us to ask, and asked if I would offer the prayer. This was the first time that either Paige or I had been invited to pray at any of these meetings. I thank God for my doubts, and I thank God for my leaders, and I ask God that he would bless my family, and I ask God that I would feel comfortable with the decision. And at the end of the prayer, the bishop, with tears in his eyes, said that he had received an answer, and that it would be, quote, a disservice to your family not to allow you to perform these ordinances. Since then, I have been allowed to perform these ordinances for my sons. I am fortunate that my two leaders are genuinely good men, yet in the end, I don't know if they fully understood that my spouse and I felt that portions of the process were abusive. For example, I insisted that my wife be present, but I was finally persuaded to have a one-on-one with the stake president. In that meeting, he had specifically asked if I had committed adultery. And he then went on to ask me sexually explicit questions. This left me with a feeling that my leaders took to heart the admonition of 84:50 through 51 that implies the lack of belief results from serious sin, and that my leaders' first suspicion about my doubts was that I was somehow unfaithful to my spouse, rather than my predicament was a result of a sincere effort to answer difficult questions with integrity. I shared some of this experience at the 2005 Salt Lake Symposium on a panel. A week after the symposium, I was invited by my elders' quorum to teach one of the quorum lessons a few weeks later. I was invited to pray in sacrament meeting. My elders' quorum president had been very kind about the issues, my issues of doubt, though I don't believe I've shared anything specifically with him. And he has continued to allow me and encourage me to participate in conversations during the meetings. And for the first time in a very long time, I find myself happy at church. Most weeks I'd wish I'd skipped Sunday school, but I feel that at home in my elders' quorum, and they treat me well, and I've sort of grown to love them. Interestingly, my wife and I are on different tracks, and she now attends the Evangelical Church in American Fork. I've attended with her and spoken with the pastor a few times. He's aware of our situation. He hasn't been pushy or judgmental. He seems to be saying, come once, come forever, come for a while, bring the kids, don't bring the kids. But my wife is finding happiness there, and I'm very happy for her. During the early part of my Stage 4 journey, I had the chance to chat with James Fowler at the Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium workshop on stage theory. I told him that I had Mormonized his theory and then described stages 3, 4, and 5 using Mormon experience and vocabulary, hoping this would expand on my retooling of his work. I was very disappointed when he told me that I essentially had it correct. Desperate and frustrated, I expressed that I was in stage 4 and that I couldn't fathom how to reach stage 5. He then described stage 5 as a train, and he said, if you're not standing in the tracks, you're not going to get hit. Before moving on to the next person, he said, Tom, you stop praying. Stage 5 seems to me to be a reconciliation about several things, just as stage 4 is about, let's see, just as stage 4 is a step away from one's tradition, stage 5 is a step back towards personal spirituality. People in stage three often see those in stage four as behind them in spiritual development. Stage four folks look at people in stage five in much the same way I perceive my friends who are most likely finding an inroad to stage five as sellouts. And as of late, I find myself in an unusual junction. My friends who were in many ways my gateway to doubt have suddenly began talking about performing ordinances for their children, having visions, embracing Jesus. My friend Dan actually puts the odds of the Book of Mormon being real history better than zero. My friend Grant Palmer encourages me to find a personal relationship with the teachings of Jesus. Another spoke of a vision about his unborn children. Sometimes when I'm talking to these friends, I find myself looking around, wondering if I'm on candid camera. Yet in a strange way, what Fowler said to me that would help me push through stage four is beginning to come true in my own life. All of a sudden, I'm finding things such as synchronicity and old-fashioned warm fuzzies returning to my life without, and it's just simply a mystery to me as to what it means. Several weeks back in Elder's Quorum, I had one of the most spiritual experiences in probably a decade. The experience for me doesn't make Joseph Smith a prophet. It doesn't correct the errors in Mormon history. It doesn't make Gordon B. Hinckley a direct conduit to Jesus. But it was something, and it's profound. And for me, it has value. I've had two friends in the past, in the midst of my anger, I have two close friends that used to gang up on me over lunch, and I would say outrageous overstatements about the church. And these guys used to make fun of me about all this. And over the past few months, both these guys have stopped going to church, and they express anger and serious doubts about Mormonism. And it's been very frustrating with me in our recent conversations, because at the same time they were giving me a bad time about my doubts, I was and have since been an active Latter-day Saint. But this fact seems to have no influence on their willingness to persevere with the church. So here I stand in a strange juncture. My family and community view me as a heretic. My believing friends are leaving the church. I find that many of my mentors are becoming sellouts. And I find myself completely alone in one of the most honest, comfortable spiritual states that I've ever experienced. As I said when I began, unfortunately, that there's this idea in stage three that people are ahead of another if they're in a different stage. I don't think anyone's really ahead. We're all on a journey, and there seems to be difficult, disorienting sections on the road, and we are all better for them. It's almost as if someone planned it that way. Thank you.
Tom, the last thing that you said, would you repeat it?
It's almost as if someone planned it that way. Someone has planned it that way.
Well, we're past the time to leave, so I'm happy to let that happen. But that was very powerful. I'm really glad that Tom did that. One of the things that's on my brain, so this may come out in an editorial in the coming day, but let me just try it out on you. In fact, Phil's more Sunstone mantras today. You know, actually, I peeked at those a while ago, but I've been thinking about this for a long time. And it's this idea that average members don't think, you know, and the stuff like that. And one of the things that really has been on my mind to share with a Sunstone-type audience is, and it kind of fits with this last little bit that Tom is saying, wherever we are, it's perfect for us. Uh-huh. And that's what we need to recognize, and it's all throughout the literature. So there's lots more besides James Fowler's, Ken Wilber, you know, just tons of other thinkers. I really like a book by Jenny Wade. There's this idea that no matter where you are, it's exactly where you're supposed to be. Because life is working, you know, and as long as you continue to ask questions, you're going to do fine. And so when I think of these Sunstone mantras that he came up with as danger zones for us, I always want to remind myself that, guess what?
that was me. to have looked at me, you know, just 10 years ago, you would have said, oh, he doesn't think for himself. You know, in other words, I just want to honor the fact that I believe that every person really is on a journey. And that if you do have these fun conversations with them in the hallways, we really do learn that from the other people there. And so I'm just glad to celebrate this. And I worry that we're hating a part of ourselves when we cast aspersions on those who aren't there. Yeah.
And your needs, you know, your needs have to be met. And so wherever your needs are met, then that's great. But it's if your needs aren't met, then you have to do something different. But if your needs are met, it doesn't matter where you are. You're happy.
Right. And it's a monumental accomplishment for some people to even become a stage three person, especially if like they're a victim of abuse or something. And so for us to say, oh, this person believes that, you know, Jesus is, you know, she prays and Jesus, you know, she has a vision of Jesus comforting her, and we're all saying, oh, brother, oh, my heck, you know, what a, that's you know, our autobiographies sometimes is monumental to get even to any kind of stability.
Well, I don't know if I buy that. I mean, if we say that stage six is living like Jesus, I mean, that seems to be a goal. You know, I teach students, and I think I want to teach my students how to think more critically. Now, sometimes I think, should I just let them be happy in their own little world? Well, they'll believe whatever anyone tells them. I don't know. I it seems to me like there are some things that are good and that we want to strive for toward a higher level of thinking. I mean, and I'm talking about that with critical thinking, but...
I think that we understand where you're coming from. And again, the literature will talk about, again, you know, I mean, there should be a, there's goals to do, but you can never skip a stage. And so one of the most important things that we've learned in all this is, you know, like, for instance, I talked about the brain development. It's not until the neocortex is fully functional that you can even separate the symbol from the what it symbolizes. So your child who says, that flag touched the ground, we have to burn it, Dad, is not the time for the lesson on, well, you know, in other words, there's this wisdom in order of all things, and you can never skip a stage. Mary Beth Raines, I really like her model for these stages. She uses the collapsible drinking cup model. You know how you have, when you're camping, it's a little flat disc, and so all it'll hold is a little bit there, but then you go up to the next level, it'll hold a little bit more and a little bit more, but always... all stages, you know, are part of the equation, and we need to honor the role that each one did. But you're right. I remember I taught senior couples at the MTC for 2.5 years, and I was, you know, I have to admit that it was shocking to hear 60 and 70-year-old women, or, I mean, 70-year-old couples basically telling the same stories at the same level of understanding as what you get in mutual. You know, that they'd never... You know, that was struggling. And so, yeah, there's a little level of me that wants to judge that. But on the other hand, I really don't know their full life story. You know, and I know that even like Phil, you know, Phil had these wonderful goals. What did he say? Set more goals, read, pray. You know, I just want to honor the fact that all of us are journeying.
Push the questions off, Jack.
So, okay, later. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.